Welcome, Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
And I am truly honored to have Gary Gulman as our guest today. I've had the opportunity to know him from several years through KVML, and Gary, we're really thankful to have you here.
Oh, I'm very grateful and honored to be a part of this. I wandered into the library and met you the first time I was there, and we've been friends ever since.
And it's been fantastic. I mean, I was remembering today going back to Morty's Comedy Club here in Indianapolis and seeing a show with you. And it's truly an honor.
Awesome.
So KVML is the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. Max talks in shorthand, so every now and then I just put people up to speed.
We do.
I met him the same way, Gary. I walked into the library one day and we started talking, and now I've got one of the best friends of my life. So I think the library deserves a round of applause for the good connections it's made over the years. People who love Vonnegut.
Yeah. They're really thoughtful, kind people. And I mean, just the context made me feel very, very comfortable around Max and anyone, associated with the library.
Yeah. So when did you start reading Vonnegut?
I read Slaughterhouse-Five in high school. And then I think I started reading some of the short stories in college. And then just after college, started reading them one after the other until at this point, I've read every single thing he's written at least three times.
Wow.
In some cases, five or six times. And right now I'm listening to Sirens of Titan. I had never listened to an audio version of Kurt's work. So it's really well done.
Who's the reader on that one? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, I can't remember right now.
I'll look for it later.
Does a great job. He does a lot of the voices and does a child's voice for Chrono. And he's very talented.
Nice.
So, Gary, I've been reading your book, and I see Vonnegut in you, or I hear him in my head. I don't know if I could give you a better compliment than that. So I'll try and be nice over the whole course of the interview, but I really appreciated you. You know what I love about Vonnegut is when I read him, I don't feel like I'm alone.
No.
Right? And I felt that way with your book. In fact, I almost felt too close to you.
Oh, wow. Like,
the only good thing about going to Catholic school and being tormented was the fact that the Jewish friends I had in the neighborhood didn't have to go to that school. Right? And I found out that they get tormented too.
Yeah. I mean, I had nice teachers, but the kids could be trouble, I remember. And also the hours were complicated because I had been in school all day. And then after school, I had to spend another 3 hours learning this foreign language and other history. And it was wasted on a young person. Now I'd probably look forward to going, but as a young person, I resented it and I did everything in my power to get out of it.
And I think I need to point out now why I wanted you on here. So I had the opportunity to see you in a show at Butler University. This was my experience sitting in the audience. So as we've established, I tend to talk to people and I was talking to people in the audience. And I was getting all of these people who were suffering from depression, anxiety, and they were just elated that you had come out and shared your struggles with mental health issues. And it's like getting to know Kurt Vonnegut. They felt like they knew somebody that had been there, and it was just tremendous for them. And I wanted to recognize that because that is incredible that you brought that out and it's been so resonant with so many people.
Yeah, I felt kind of an obligation to share my story. I wouldn't even say an obligation, but it's sort of I was so appreciative of the people who had opened up about their struggles and their stories of coming out on the other side that I wanted to add to that and help some people. And I had always hoped I would be the type of person who would be able to do that once they were healthy enough to just, because when you're in the midst of it, you can't imagine doing much more than getting through the day.
Right.
And And so I hoped that I would have the energy and the will to share that, and thank heavens or the universe or whatever that I have had the energy. And so, I mean, one thing you think when you're sick is that everything is draining you, because it is. But then when you get outside of that, you realize that these type of interactions and creating and spending time with people and sharing your interests, that actually energizes you and feeds you. And it's hard to get your mind around that when you're sick, when just getting into the shower is this thing you have to bargain with yourself with all day and try to talk yourself through it. And I remember being grateful that I was able to finish a shower still on my feet, because there were times when I would take a knee or I would sit in the at the bottom of the tub. So that's the thing that I was so grateful that on the other side of it, I was able to give some people some insight and indirectly some hope.
So your book, Misfit, who encouraged you to write that? Because I loved it. The fact that you've got all of these really wonderful anecdotes of, you know, your younger years, but then it's interspersed with those very personal struggles with depression. It really meant a lot to me. But like, why, how did you get the idea to write that?
Oh, well, initially, there's a comedian and actress named Jacqueline Novak. Are you familiar with her? And she's wonderful and had a wonderful show that's on Netflix called Get on Your Knees. Anyhow, she had written a book called Weeping in Public, which was this very funny memoir of her experience with depression. And she had just published that, and we met and had dinner with another friend named Bonnie McFarlane. And Jacqueline said, you have what it takes to write a book, and that your writing is strong enough in your stand-up act that you have the requisite talent and the intellect to write a book. But she didn't stop there, which is where most people usually stop. She sort of held my hand through writing a proposal, a book proposal, which was basically you write a sample chapter and then a summary of the chapters that you would include, and then a summary of what the book is about. So she really helped me through that and helped me write it. And then I got really sick. And for 4 or 5 years, I was barely able to keep my stand-up bookings, never mind work on a book or pitch a book that I just had no confidence that anybody would be interested in this. And then after my HBO special, The Great Depression, came out, which was where I sort of explained my lifelong battle with depression and how I got out of this particularly extensive 2.5 year episode of depression, then some publishers were interested in publishing a book, and they said, do you have any ideas? And I said, well, I have this proposal that I wrote before I got really sick, and they loved it. And there were several publishers interested, and I chose to work with Flatiron Books, which is a division of Macmillan. And I got this great editor named Will Schwalbe, who was also a writer himself, who wrote a great book that you guys would love called The End of Your Life Book Club. It was a book club that he and his mother started. His mother was dying of cancer, and for 2 years, they had this book club where they would discuss these books with the backdrop of her mother winding down her life. She was a really special woman, and he's an incredible man. And so anyhow, I wrote that book, and it was very therapeutic. I found it very helpful to be writing about a sometimes sad part of my life, but also have a therapist that I could bring the ideas and events to and get some perspective on them. And this is something I got from Kurt Vonnegut, who said, you should create and you should write, even if you just put it into a drawer. It is food for the soul. So I really think it's helpful, and maybe more helpful than if you have to publish this, to just write about events in your life or memories that you have. I find it so therapeutic, and I don't know that I would have done it without the motivation from a publisher and an editor, but but I'm so glad I did. And I'll definitely do it again.
I'm good. You know, it's funny. I was reading your book and I thought, I wonder if this is ghostwritten. Because, sorry, but I'm such a, excuse me, I'm a journalist and I'm such a writing snob. Not that my own writing comes up to my snobbery level, but I am a snob of what I read. And it's, your sentences are really fabulous and beautiful. And I really loved the writing. And it's, aside from the fact that I think I had about 150,000 flashbacks and I might have some leftover residual trauma. I lived your childhood, but I turned out the other way. Okay. I lived your childhood, but I turned out to an, it turned into an extrovert, overcompensator. My problem in the shower is I can't stay there long enough to get clean. I have to run and do the next thing. I constantly overcommit and underdeliver because I just have to be, you know, I loved, you know, loved is a really wrong word, but I don't have a better word for it. I was passionately attached to the way you described depression.
Oh.
Because for a person like me, I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Right? I don't understand the feeling that you can't stay standing.
Yeah. It's interesting because I read this book by William Styron called Darkness Visible. And I've read it a few times. And one of the things he was able to get across so well, or sort of underline this idea, which is that one of the most frustrating things about depression is that the English language doesn't have a word for it that differentiates itself from just being sad. So the same thing we use to say, well, our baseball team lost, we're depressed, but it's different. That doesn't include the physical component and the suicidal ideations and everything else that goes along with it. And in another story I read called The Depressed Person by David Foster Wallace, the depressed person, one of the most frustrating things about this person's life is their inability to describe to people who haven't felt it what it feels like to be depressed. And that was such a struggle with me because I have to admit, I never thought I got it right, either in my special or in my book. I never thought that I was able to describe what it felt like, to find the right metaphor, to find the right analogy, to describe it. And so it's very nice to hear that people say that they've used it to express to their family how they feel or other people. That feels really good. But I have to say that I aspired towards it, but I never felt like I nailed it.
Well, you know, this is just my interpretation, but I'd seen your stand up before I read your book, right? Probably most people have.
Yeah.
And for me to hear, read your words, that you didn't think you could do it, that you didn't have, that really keyed me into what your depression was more than anything. It's like, how can this guy not feel capable?
Like, no kidding.
How can this be happening to him?
Yeah.
That really was what drove it home for me.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. But that's the nature, the insidious nature of it, is that it lies to you and tells you you're not good enough. And it's so hard. You need a third party to give you some objectiveness. And sometimes the third party isn't enough. So it's very frustrating.
And it was important to me. So I agree with Pat. Me personally, I've been sad, but I've never been in the depths of depression like that. Having said that, I have three children who have very much been in those depths. Mm. And so to have your descriptions of what that was like and to get a better understanding from you honestly helped me with my own children. And I can't thank you enough.
Oh, I mean, that's the greatest compliment, because that's what was missing from when I was interacting with my family, was that, I mean, at one point I gave my mother a book, but the book, after I reread it, I thought, oh, it was too It's a book called Noonday Demon by Andrew Solomon. And I remember rereading it and thinking, oh, this, his language is a little too elevated and complex for my mom, who's not a big reader. And so I felt bad. I had, not that I had given her the wrong book. It was just, I mean, the other thing is that most people don't really follow up much more than how are you feeling. They don't really ask what types of thoughts are you having and what does this feel like? What is your brain telling you? And it's one of those things where without either study or having been in these situations yourself, it is very difficult to empathize or to put yourself in the person's shoes. It's very frustrating.
And on the other side of that, as a person who's being asked how you feel today, you play the game. The game is I'm great, you know, and it doesn't matter how you're feeling. And that dishonesty just creates this thing where people don't get to understand what it's really like for those people that are struggling. And I truly appreciate my friends who will tell me absolutely straightforward, honestly, I don't have the bandwidth today or whatever. That is so helpful.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Max. Just kidding. I also think people are, the world's governed by fear, right? And I think people are afraid to find out you're not feeling good. I think people don't want you to tell them something bad about you because they don't feel capable of fixing it. Yeah. And so they don't, so, and that's reciprocal, right? You don't want to burden them because they can't fix it. And, but if the person who you're talking to, who let's say they're firing on all cylinders and they're more than capable of lending a hand, if they're afraid they can't fix it, how is the first person in the depths of depression who is firing on a half a cylinder, how are they supposed to fix it? Right? That's the, you talk to the most capable human you meet and they don't even, please, no, you know, and it's just this, there's so much to the whole idea of it. I my primary area of expertise is poverty. And I've spent many, many years being an administrator in homeless shelters. People don't want to talk about that either, right? No. Anything that's a burden, anything that's a huge problem, anything that can't be fixed easily, and anything that could happen to them.
Yeah.
Right? The fear that I might one day wake up and not be able to get out of bed because I'm just so overwhelmed. I don't want that to happen to me. I don't even want to know it's possible.
Yeah. That's so insightful. I think, but as Max said, Max understands, and this is just not everyone, but Max understands that there's an intimacy and a depth to a friendship that goes beyond how are you, good, let's move on. So what maybe people are afraid of is intimacy. And but the other side of that is that I don't know that a friendship is complete unless it's both ways. So I feel there were people in my life who were great when I was down, but if they were down, they wouldn't tell me. And so it makes me feel that it gives, when you acknowledge or let somebody in on how you're feeling, it gives them permission on the other side. And that's where a friendship is complete. And also the other thing that I've noticed is that some friends are better when you're miserable than when you're happy. So they can't a happiness, because that requires some intimacy as well. So it's really interesting, because it seems counterintuitive that being more vulnerable would make you stronger, but that is the truth.
And yeah, absolutely the truth.
Yeah. And that the yes, there are friends who don't want to be around somebody who's down, but isn't that a great test?
Yes.
To figure out who you can really rely on. And I mean, I say this half jokingly, but my wife, we were just dating when this, I mean, we lived together, but it wasn't, there was no commitment. There was no marriage license or anything that would have required anything much more than moving some clothes out. And she stuck with me. And I say, there's no better test of somebody's commitment to you than seeing you at your worst and having to become not a lover, but a caregiver.
And I know you know this, I really wanted Sade to be with us. And I absolutely understand that, you know, it's not something that she's interested in doing. But I think of Jane Vonnegut, Jane Cox Vonnegut, and what she meant to Kurt. And I know they, you know, separated later on, but she made him and was really supportive. And to me, Sade represents that secular sainthood that she saw all the good in you and stuck with you and supported you through what would have been very difficult times. So I agree. That is an incredible testament to her.
Yeah.
I think she should write a book because one of the things I was thinking about while I read your book was, you know, we'd come back to the one or page and a half where you were back in your mother's house. And then we'd go back to a sort of a memoir sort of thing. But then the real time where we were in your mother's house, and I'm like, well, is he calling her on the phone? What is happening? Like I really wanted to know what was happening with you. Because here I did know from the very beginning that you ended up married to her. And I'm like, well, this is going to be this most incredible woman. And I just think I'd love to have her side now if you want to put that bug in her ear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We would speak daily, and I would go down there probably on average every 3 weeks, or she would come up. So we would see each other and talk on the phone, and she would spend time at my mom's house with me, which was funny because the same room that I grew up in, and I was an adult, the same size bed. It was, I mean, sometimes I look back on the recovery as being as enjoyable as where I am now, because it was gradual, and I would feel a little bit better, and I would start to do things that I hadn't done in so long. And so that felt really good. There was always a fear of backsliding that I don't have now, which feels really good. But there was that sort of, oh my gosh, I'm enjoying certain things that I hadn't been able to face in so long. And she was able to be there for a part of it, but there was always knocking on wood and waiting for the other shoe to drop. And just, you never know how durable the recovery will be, but I'm at 7 years and counting now. And as my psychiatrist points out at every one of our sessions, the longer you go, the more durable and less likely a relapse is. So it's really, I'm so grateful.
That reminds me of the notes that you've been putting on Facebook as well. So I've really gravitated to those. And I know I didn't ask your permission to like share them. And I have been like tagging you every time I share one, because it's like, I hope he understands that I'm just honored to have these represented on Sacred Legions. But one, every note is just this wonderful piece of advice for someone who may be going through those things that you suffered from. And they're so artistically done. There's just little trinkets of, like, one of my favorites was the tombstone with the Kurt Vonnegut quote. Why can't I remember it?
Beautiful and nothing.
Yeah. Everything was beautiful and nothing hurt. Thank you. I am suffering from lots of lack of sleep from traveling on a train for the last 20 to 48 hours.
Wow. But
I just love the way that those notes come across. And one that I'll bring up specifically, there's references to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not because you were particularly tied into Alcoholics Anonymous, but the advice is very similar and very true. It's like, you should be applauded for how long it's been without a relapse, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. But again, those notes, I knew starting in 2025 that a lot of thoughtful, kind people were going to be feeling bad. And so I wanted something. And also the other great thing of sharing your knowledge is that it reinforces what you know. And it reminds you, oh, have I done this thing that I'm recommending people do? Have I done it today? Or have I been doing it? And it's really helpful. I forget where I heard you got to you got to give it away to keep it, or something like that. And that resonated with me. And I really found that just doing that. And the other thing comes from Kurt Vonnegut's favorite author, who was Mark Twain, who said, if you want to cheer yourself up, cheer somebody else up. So that I found really helpful.
And I really love how well read you are. I mean, it's obvious from your comedy. If anybody listening has not heard your stand up, I truly encourage them to find a show or find a special on HBO. I know you've got several on HBO, but to watch your stand up, because your mastery of language is just magnificent. It's really a lot of fun.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. And I just love to read. I remember as a kid, my mom took me to see Fiddler on the Roof, and I loved it. And there's that one song where he talks about being rich. And the main thing I took away from that was that he wanted to be able to read all day. And I remember thinking, even at a young age, yes, that is the greatest benefit of being rich. And I'm not rich, but my job allows me to spend my days. I mean, I read probably on average 6 hours a day, and my wife does the same. So it's just something. And also I've noticed that. And I remember Stephen King said this, in his book on writing, he had a list of all the books he had read in the past year. And it was insane how much a guy who writes all the time was reading. And I don't think you can write great unless you're reading a lot. I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but I really think it's part of the just filling your brain and your inventory with words and phrases. And also, I mean, the other thing that people who don't read enough are missing out on is this opportunity to reinforce or build empathy. And just that a novelist is so great at getting you into the headspace and the lives of other people in cultures or communities that you would never have a part of, and you understand. I mean, and this is also from just getting to know people, you understand that there's so much overlap and similarities throughout different cultures. I always say that I can find a version of me in just about every culture I've ever intersected with. There are just too many people for there not to be someone who you can connect with all over the world.
Yeah.
The inspirational notes that Max is referring to, just for folks' edification, you can go to the Sacred Legions page on Facebook. And we want you to like it.
Or, I mean, you can go directly to Gary Goldman's Facebook page, where I think you got through at least 100 of them. Did it end at
100? Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. I even downloaded all those to my computer. Again, I really appreciated them.
If you take out a protection order against Max after this is over, we won't be too surprised.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can go to the Sacred Legions page. You can like it. You can hang out with us. And you can see these notes that have been curated by Max Goller that will lead you to Gary's page, I'm sure, before long. It's hard to do the housework with you around, Max. You keep interrupting the part where I'd have to do the boring tease our own stuff.
I appreciate that. I want to say something too. I want to go back to the point where you were talking about creating art, and it's the concept of that Kurt Vonnegut had of make your soul grow, right?
Yeah.
So he had a specific instruction. He wrote a letter to a school. A teacher had someone write him a letter, and he responded back. One of the few authors that responded back. And in it, he gave the students an assignment. When I was teaching eighth grade English, I was so moved by this assignment he gave that I gave it to my students, which was, you write a poem. It doesn't have to rhyme. It just write a poem. And when you're done with it, you immediately tear it into little pieces. You take the little pieces and you distribute them in garbage cans throughout the school for the rest of the day. So it is for nobody else. It is just to make your soul grow. And so I gave that assignment the first time, and I will say that I was not the most popular teacher with my janitors that year my students didn't necessarily find the garbage cans. They found places to leave the pieces, but it wasn't the garbage cans.
Oh, wow. That's wild. What books did you cover in eighth grade?
Specifically, so with Kurt Vonnegut, in my advanced classes, we did Slaughterhouse-Five. That's the one that you tend to do anyways. I did a bunch of short stories, like All the King's Men is one that I will always remember. And that one I dissected, and this is going to get deep in the rough for people who don't know Kurt Vonnegut, but it was like based on a chess story, and you've got real pieces and then you've got human pieces, and it's a standard trope of a story. But the thing that I loved was I paired the story with video version of it. And the story was written during the Cold War with, I think, Korea. And the updated version took on more of a Central American feel.
Wow.
And so it was interesting to say, the idea doesn't change. It doesn't matter where the wars are. The message is still the same.
Yeah. Wow. And see, I felt even reading Slaughterhouse-Five in 10th or 11th grade that, and I read it on my own. It wasn't part of the curriculum for whatever reason, but I found that I appreciated it much more the five or six times I read it older than that, and that it was more meaningful, and that there were certain aspects that I enjoyed probably more as a kid, but I didn't understand it fully until I was older and had also lived through the first Gulf War and then 9/11. I mean, I guess it's not surprising that he was so prescient. Maybe it's irritating that we keep making the same mistakes over and over again than it is prescient. It's just,
yes,
nobody learns.
Yeah. Or I think that's people. Why his writing turned to time travel, right? With Time Quake and some of the other stuff where he started, you know, really getting literal in his pointing out the fact that we just go back and do it again.
Yeah.
Well, and if you're like the current situation where let's just erase all of history, it never happened. All of those bad things, it never happened. And it's like, that is exactly what we should be looking at, is where these things happen. And let's please, for God's sake, let's stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the one thing we can learn from this move to erase it is that we got back here again without it being erased. So it was there. We had access to it and we've chosen to ignore it. Again, it's that difficulty of talking to you about the things that are upsetting and jarring. It's the difficulty of dealing. We made this big deal about denazifying Germany, but we never denazified the United States. You know, we never owned the atrocities of our own history. So even without erasing it, we brought ourselves here.
Yeah.
So not to be the Debbie Downer of the talk about depression.
No, I find that so insightful. And it's extraordinary.
Right. And I think these guys are thinking that they'll perpetuate it. But I don't know. I teeter. When you were talking about, you know, how much you read, I was thinking about your lost Dr. Seuss book and you swearing you'll never read again. Right. And then talking about why don't people have admiration for this particular thing? But Mrs. Rand, who could appreciate anything after Mrs. Rand, right? Horrible teacher in school bullied you so much. And then I wonder when you do your stand up when you say you bring joy to other people as a way to deal with your own sorrow, you do it. I mean, that is your exhibit A, right? But then I wonder, do you ever think, I wonder how many bullies read my stuff?
Oh, geez. That's a great question. I remember when Nirvana got really popular, Kurt Cobain especially was so ambivalent because he said fraternity bros and bullies were enjoying his music. And even though he was deriding them, and it's just... Yeah, I don't know. I do know that I've been open about my politics over the past 8 years, both explicitly and implicitly, And so every few days I'll get a message from somebody telling me to shut up and tell jokes and whatnot. But I've found it to be to expressing my feelings about the current administration to be helpful in filtering out really awful people from my audience. And I mean, I don't think it's half. I don't think half of the people who come to see me are voting for fascism and cruelty, but there were probably 10% maybe or less who liked me because I was clean or for other reasons. And I said to my wife, I said, this was great. I said, why do I have any people who voted MAGA in my audience who are so angry at me? And she said, well, that's how funny you are, that your jokes reach across the aisle. And so she said, it's actually a compliment, but it's frustrating because I mean, I've been so clear about my feelings of about how I always feel with Kurt Vonnegut's books that I can't believe we had any wars after his books came out. And I often can't believe that capitalism survived the Grapes of Wrath, and it survived Death of a Salesman and the movie Parasite and this new series I've been watching called Severance, which is a real indictment against capitalism. But I'm sure there are ardent capitalists who love Severance and who enjoyed the Death of a Salesman. And to me, these are arguments, fail-safe, foolproof arguments against capitalism and for socialism. And I don't understand. That's how entrenched capitalism is and how nefarious it is as a philosophy.
Well, it's almost like saying that's how war is entrenched, right? You have all these great anti-war novels too. And it's like, none of this makes sense. And yet we still do it in amounts.
Yeah.
I think that's the other point you made though, about, I feel the same way about Vonnegut. My first experience with Vonnegut was nothing but stark raving terror because I was in ninth grade and a nun, never getting over it, a nun made us read Cat's Cradle.
Wow.
Which was so frightening, right? I was already nuts, right?
Yeah.
I didn't need, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I just mean incapable of functioning as a ninth grader.
Yeah.
And to read about a chemical, which of course was an allegory for nuclear war, but it was right. And I was petrified and I didn't sleep for months. And so my mom went to college when I was in high school because she had been a dropout in World War II and everything. And she read Slaughterhouse-5 and begged me to read it with her. And I was in college by then, which was maybe 6 years later. I said, oh, Mom, I don't know about that guy. You know?
Yeah.
But when I read that, she wanted me to read so she'd have someone to talk to, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe what's missing from all these great books and movies and films and TV shows is you digesting it alone is difficult. That's how I felt about East of Eden. I wanted everybody I knew to read East of Eden so I could talk about. I didn't know how anyone could read East of Eden before someone had looked in their face and told them that they loved them and then lied to them.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, how, and maybe if you're a 5 year old, you get that from your parents and you don't know that's what it is, the lie of love, right? But that, in your, I think Steinbeck, Vonnegut, everything, you're never going to get it till you're 40.
Yeah.
Right.
But when you read Cat's Cradle in the ninth grade, you had nobody you could share your horror with. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It's interesting to me, too. So when I first got to know Pat, you know, if you're a Vonnegut fan or if you're a fan of any author, for that matter, there's always the comparison of, well, what's your favorite book? Right. And so Cat's Cradle was hands down my favorite book. It wasn't the first thing I read by Vonnegut. But once I got it, it was like, that's the one that I love. And my youngest child recently, or maybe my daughter, I don't know, one of my children asked me, why do you resonate with Cat's Cradle? It's not, you know, I couldn't quite get it. And I said, well, you got to look back of, I grew up with this kind of religious trauma. And here I get a book that's telling me all of that stuff is nonsense and doing it so well. And I just, yep, that's my book. And I love everything that he's written, but that one just resonated with that traumatized fundamental. Yeah.
I wonder the mindset of the nun who recommended that, because she had
Martha,
to have...
I'll out her like you out yours. Sister Martha.
She had to understand, first of all, that it was going to be heavy for kids, and also that it was contradictory to her position in life. Wow. Yeah.
Maybe she was feeling those questions of faith at the time too.
Yeah.
Well, she did leave. She did leave the convent about 10 years, maybe 10 years later.
We now know.
I actually harbor no resentment against Sister Martha, because I now that I'm an old lady feminist, and I was actually a young lady feminist at one time, or never a lady, but a feminist. In high school, my best friend and I tried to stop the homecoming queen selection, because we said this is just objectifying girls and making them compete on a level that is arbitrary, and we should stop it. And then all the rotten kids in my school ganged up and voted for me and my best friend to be homecoming queen, just to be mean, you know, just Catholic school. Oh. But I do know that whatever gets a young woman to the point of becoming a nun, and then to the point of living through that sort of paternalism, and then actually leaving it, probably makes, if I knew who Sister Martha was now, probably one of my heroes. If I could get to know her better.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I just read a book that I can't stop thinking about, by a woman named Madeline, and the last name is spelled T-H-I-E-N, and it's called The Book of Records, and it's a novel, and three of the main characters are historical people. So it's Hannah Arendt, Baruch Spinoza, and the Chinese poet who I'd never heard of called Du Fu. And it just, I mean, if you go through my books and see what I highlighted, it can tell you how much things resonated with me. And it's just, it's mostly highlighting. What I should have done is just left the things blank that I didn't find riveting. And there was a moment where Hannah Arendt and her husband, and it was not clear to me who was speaking, because they didn't indicate who was saying what, but one of them said, regarding Germany, they said, "We were fools." And then the other person said, "No, we were fooled. There's a difference."
Yes.
And that's what Sister Martha just reminded me in me that Sister Martha was no fool, but she was taken in. Yeah. And it is heroic, because you have to then admit that you were, part of you wants to say I was a fool, but then it's easier to say I was fooled. And we can all look back on relationships or friendships or beliefs that we had, and it was because we didn't have all the information.
Yeah.
How heavily written in are your books? This is off on a tangent, but you were talking about highlighting that book, and it reminded me of my son, who writes all over his books,
like
notes and pictures and all of this. Do you do that?
Yes. Yes. And my wife is the same way, although I would say she doesn't so much read as she does study. Like there's going to be an exam. I mean, everything she reads is so heavily marked up, and I remember this essay that I think it was Francis Bacon wrote about the difference between different books. Some are meant to be tasted, others meant to be chewed. And then she's a person who just, if she gets into a book, she just immerses and takes notes in a notebook and on the page. And so her books are just really used up by the time she's finished. But then she becomes like an expert on these things, and her comprehension and also her retention is at the highest level. She's really, really an extraordinary brain.
So students out there, being a former teacher, I got to tell you, I highly recommend this as a method of reading books. Like, books don't need to stay clean. And I I'm saying that hypocritically because I very rarely wrote in my own books. Like I did keep them clean. I've got one book that I really loved that I wrote all over and it did make a difference. And I think that is just a great practice in general.
Yeah. What book is that?
The one that I read. So my son turned me on to a book called Jerusalem by Alan Moore. And it was actually meant to be a trilogy that all got into one book. And it's a tome. It's like I read Don Quixote on a trip with Pat to England one time. And it's about that kind of tome. But it's just this beautiful exploration of Alan Moore's hometown of, I can't remember. It's in England.
Yeah.
And it's like this working class, really rough area that's totally disrespected, but he honored it in the best way that you possibly could. And it's like history from day naught of that place through the modern day. And it's just a beautiful book. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a big Alan Moore fan. He's a wonderful writer.
Yeah. Indeed he is.
Yeah.
And if you've not read Jerusalem, because that's one of his.
I haven't.
It, you know, he normally does the graphic novels. This is. An actual prose, beautiful, beautiful book. In fact, I constantly want to reread it. And it's like, but I don't have the time because I know how long it took the first time.
Right, right. Oh, it's hard.
Yeah.
I have a page here that I wrote on in your book.
Okay.
I wrote all through your book too.
Oh.
but I want to talk about my impression of you right now, which maybe is not fair, but is how absolutely deep this conversation has become, right?
Yeah.
It just there's so many tendrils that are leading to other stories and really an expression of passion for other people's abilities. But your humor, your comedy is pure distillation. You just like the one I'm thinking of off the top of my head. Well, I've talked about all the medicines you were on and you thought you had Dr. Seuss for a doctor because he just really liked to rhyme.
Yeah.
Because all the medicines rhyme. But then it also one of the funniest things that I've ever seen in my life was where the initials came from for the States, right? You distill ordinary things, this big thinking guy. And one of the distillations at the very beginning of your book that was just like slapped me in the head with how profoundly you take a moment, in my opinion, as someone who doesn't know you from a hole in the stump, is you're talking about what time of day it is. And you're saying, if it were the day before Thanksgiving, first graders would be home by now. That is such a moment in time that every single person who reads it knows exactly what that minute is. Right?
Yeah.
How do you get to your humor from all of this other thinking? Those little things just pop into your head.
I don't know. I guess part of it is there are certain formulas that you don't know there's a name for what you're doing until you study a little bit about comedy or somebody points it out. But one thing that I've always loved is a term called, I didn't know there was a term for this, but it's bathos, B-A-T-H-O-S, where it can be taking something that's very serious and making it pedestrian, or taking something very pedestrian and making it serious. And it's a very effective way to approach the world in terms of making it funny, humorous, or a little bit more interesting. And so taking the idea of how they abbreviated the States, which was probably not a dramatic or humorous activity, I had been obsessed with this book. When you don't have a lot of books growing up, you know every book you have back and forth because you've read it and reread it. And there was this book that had come out called The Arrow Book of States that I got at a book fair at school. You could take two free books. And this Arrow Book of States listed, and this had just come out when this book had been published. And so it was probably in 1973. That it was published, but they listed all the states and what their two-letter abbreviations were. And because I had nothing better to do, I memorized them. But memorizing them, you notice that a lot of them start with the same first two letters. And so when I first started doing comedy, I tried this joke where I said, must have been really hard to abbreviate all the letters because most of them start with the same first two letters. And man, nobody cared when I told that, when I told that joke. And then years later, I got in front of a particularly generous audience, and I happened to have just seen a documentary about Helvetica. And so for some reason that I will never be able to explain, I'll call it inspiration, but I told them that there was a documentary about abbreviating the states.
Oh my God.
Which is a lie. And I imitated people trying to abbreviate the states down to two letters, but took it very seriously, which I guess is bathos. And so that formula is really how I was able to make this thing that has, I like it when a comedian is able to make something that has no business being a subject of comedy, making that funny. And so that was, and then of course it took me months of adding and subtracting, and it's very iterative in a way that you don't really have the opportunity with a book as much, except your audience is your editor, and in my case, my wife and a really good friend. I would let read chapters before I sent them to my editor. But with comedy, you have this opportunity to get it in front of an audience frequently, and so you get, you're almost writing it with the audience. They don't have any input in what words you say, but they tell you which words are working. And so it's actually very gratifying if you don't give them any power over your self-esteem.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because in that skit, and people should rush right now, I talked to Max earlier, maybe we can insert, with your permission, we can insert little bits of these comedy sketches into the audio.
Yeah.
But you didn't just talk about them. You personified these imaginary people of yours, right? You gave them personality traits and reasons why they should want to be done early or whatever. And it was just brilliant.
Wasn't it Dottie? For some reason, I'm remembering the name Dottie as the secretary.
Oh, yeah, Dottie was the...
And Dottie, I love Dottie. She's a sweetheart.
Dottie was the secretary. And
I don't want to get into the weeds. This is just encouragement. Okay. Maybe we'll throw a little bit of that in there.
Guys, I hate to be a nudge, but could we get back to abbreviating the states? We still have 49 left. And apologies were made and an understanding was reached, and they got back to abbreviating. They said, what's next? They said, Alaska. Everybody cool with AL? But somebody caught it. One man sheepishly raised his hand and said, sir, I think we might have used that one before. Are you sure? I'm pretty sure. Well, let's check the minutes. Dottie, read the minutes back to us, hon. Dottie was the wisecracking secretary. Every 1970s office had a wisecracking secretary, and this one's name was Dottie. And Dottie was a pistol. You would love, she was a real hot ticket. Dottie, listen to what Dottie said. They said, Dottie, read the minutes. How Dottie is this? He said, read the minutes back to us. This is so Dottie. And she goes, you mean the minute?
It is. I got to tell you, this was amazing to me, because you were talking about, we didn't have books as kids and we were so excited to have a book. Right. And I remember getting the Scholastic flyers and taking them home and, mom, I just want a book in this list. Right. And so to think that one of these books that came home from school that you loved so much ended up becoming what, to me, I hear a lot of people now request that abbreviation of states. You know, even now it seems like that's a very popular sketch, if I'm to guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know which, I don't want to consider myself a one-hit wonder.
Oh, no, you've got a lot more
right?
than that.
But it would be, if I were, Born to Run is to Bruce Springsteen as the abbreviating the states is to Gary Goldman. That's my most popular work, yeah.
So where are you going to be next? Where can people find you?
Oh, I think that mostly in the summer I work out in Brooklyn and in Queens. I do one room that's called Union Hall and another comedy club that's called QED, like the Latin QED. And so I do that in June 18th and June 25th. And then in July, I have some dates there too. And then I'll be on the road in the fall doing a one-person show that I wrote called Grandiloquent, which is, it's sort of, it's inspired by Misfit, but it's it takes one story from Misfit and makes it into a one person show. So I find it really fun to dwell on one subject for a while and inspect it and analyze it. So that this is a good example. I feel like my entire 31-year comedy career has been leading to being able to do this particular show, because it requires having an audience who will be patient, because there's a part of the show that's more drama than comedy. And it's something you couldn't do at a Friday night comedy club. It requires you to have an audience who's familiar with your work and trusts you.
Wow, Max, we're going to have to find a location and go see it.
I want to bring it to the Shroud Center, but I am going to be doing it in Chicago, but I'm going to try to bring it to Butler again.
Okay, because I know you did it at Butler, and I had it on my calendar, like, okay, Gary's coming to the Shroud again, I got to go see him. And I knew it was the Grand Eloquent show, which I was really looking forward to seeing. And somehow, not surprising, you know, life is just absorbs. And I lost track of it and didn't get to see it.
No, I have not done the Grand Eloquent at Butler. I did the Misfit. I did the Misfit show at Butler, but it's different. And so I'll keep you posted.
Good, because now I don't feel quite so badly. Because
you don't have to feel bad. You didn't miss it. No, you were there because I signed books for you.
Well, definitely I was there for the Misfit. Not only that, so I want to do a shout out to you. This is how much I appreciate you. I was volunteering at the Ray Bradbury Center at the time that we went to see Misfit. And you provided passes for us to come back into your green room before the show. The people that were with me were so excited to be able to do this. Like, I cannot tell you how excited they were. And that to me was such a special treat, that just having this relationship with you, I don't feel like it's that close, but you made it.
I don't want to scare you off.
it probably goes back to that idea that you just don't feel worthy. Right. So,
yeah.
But it was a great thing to be able to do. And I do really enjoy seeing you on any tour you're on. So,
yeah,
well, I'm in Pennsylvania. So if you're in Philly or anywhere around I'll drag him out my way.
Yeah, we announced Philly shows today. So it should be on my Facebook. And I can't remember the name of the, but it's a nice theater that seats the right amount of people so that it can be intimate.
Great. Right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put all that connection to all your stuff onto our site too.
So I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Hook up and make sure they see you.
Absolutely. And I can't thank you enough. One, for taking your time today to be with us, but even more for being out there and letting people know that you can get through it and you're not alone.
Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, well, nice knows nice, Max. And I knew walking in that day, because anytime I go to a new place, I'm always anxious, and you made me feel right at home right away. And so it was, as they say in Casablanca, it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
It is. And I got to tell you, I was mentioning this kind of imposter syndrome of I'm not worthy of Gary Goldman, but I do remember one time the CEO of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library, Julia Whitehead, specifically told me on one occasion, Gary Goldman's coming back into town for something, and he would like to see you at some event that we're doing. And I didn't think, I'm like, why would Gary Goldman even know who the hell I am? So I was truly honored by that, and I thank you.
No.
And I'm completely honored that you've been willing to join us at the podcast.
And it was because you stole his laptop. Finish the story.
No.
We wanted his laptop back.
We hit it off, and I don't know if you can tell how long my hair is, but there is something about a middle-aged man with long hair that always makes me feel safe.
I was going to tell you, I so love your look now. And you had a few different looks, and I love the way you look. And maybe that's me projecting myself, but you're looking great. So
thank you. Thank you. And Pat, it was so nice to meet you, and I look forward to seeing you in Philadelphia or elsewhere. And thank you for your generosity.
Well, thanks for your time doing the show with us. It's been awesome.
Awesome. All right. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler and Pat LaMarche. Original music by Jamie Calland. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.